How can faith and reason work together? Are they somehow mutually exclusive? What role do facts and evidence play in the Christian faith? This is Reasonable Faith, Conversations with Dr. William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris, and today we're discussing Dr. Craig's book, Reasonable Faith. Now, I want to remind you as we begin this conversation that there are many resources like this podcast available at reasonablefaith.org. The media are calling it the new atheism. Dr. Craig, the new atheism doesn't seem to be really all that new, but it has been branded as such, and it seems to be swirling around some bestsellers by atheist philosophers and thinkers, and it's now been branded the new atheism.
Right. I don't think that the content is original or new. When you look at, for example, one of these authors, Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, I was rather surprised to see that it's just rehashed material from the Skeptical Inquirer and other books by Prometheus Press and so forth. It's not really anything that hasn't already made its rounds in the free thought or infidel subculture. But what is surprising, and I think is culturally significant, Kevin, is the reception that these books have received. They've become bestsellers. And that's different. Before, books published by the free thought presses didn't make much impact culturally, but now these are being widely read, and so that is significant.
The list is growing, and it's Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, and now Christopher Hitchens who comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And what we see now is people who are actually trying to write on this topic because they've seen it to be successful. And
yeah.
So we could expect to see some more of these.
Yeah, absolutely. There's big bucks to be made here. And in addition to these fellows, you have all of these apocalyptic books warning that the sky is falling if the religious right should take over America and turn it into a sort of Christian Taliban, and very alarmist books warning about the political future of the United States. It goes hand in hand with these new atheism books. And I think probably a lot of the interest in the new atheism is born out of a fear of both the religious right as well as of Islam and fundamentalist Islam.
Also, it's a very savvy marketing ploy in that a book about atheism, which is so polarizing, appeals to people who are atheist, appeals to people who are very opposed to atheism because they want to read it in order to see what they're up to. And then people who are kind of in the middle who are curious. And so you seem to hit three or four targets there.
Right. I'm very curious myself to know what the reception of these books is among the neutral. Obviously, the small percentage of people that are atheists will receive these with great enthusiasm. But I'm very curious and would like to know, are these books really persuading many people to move toward an atheistic point of view? And that I'm not sure of. That's going to take time to tell, I suppose.
Again, we can thank the media for branding this movement, so to speak. It doesn't seem those in atheism, the prominent thinkers in atheism, or the free thought movement and so forth, have branded themselves as the new atheism. But they're glad to kind of pick up the
right
mantle.
Did you read the article in Wired magazine where it used that title, I think, for the first time? That was where it was given to them.
And it caught on. And
it
definitely
did.
Yeah.
And I was struck by how biased that article was. It was written by a fellow who was obviously very disaffected with religion and very eager to embrace Dawkins' point of view, even though in the end he decided he wasn't going to become a belligerent atheist himself. But this kind of new atheism really appeals to, I think, a lot of secular folks out there who are just sort of non-religious and are troubled by people who have a deep religious faith and react, I think, fearfully sometimes against it.
There is one aspect of the new atheism that I think is rather new, Dr. Craig, and that is what I think seems to be a new definition or a redefinition of atheism. There is kind of a traditional definition of atheism, the belief that God does not exist.
Right.
And then this rather, it seems to me, new definition of atheism that I see constantly, and that is someone who just lacks belief in God.
Right. I don't think that move is characteristic of these new atheists like Dennett and Dawkins and Harris. I think these fellows are old-line, okay, hard-nosed atheists. But you're certainly correct, Kevin, in saying that out there in the popular level, there are lots of atheists who are reinterpreting atheism so that it's no longer a viewpoint, but rather it's the description of a psychological state, namely the state of being without a belief in God. And as such, it really trivializes atheism, because now atheism isn't a viewpoint. It's no longer true or false. It's just a description of a person's psychological state, that they lack a belief in God. And so atheism is neither true nor false. It's purely a biographical sort of description, and as such, I think, is trivial. In fact, when you think about it on that definition, even little babies are atheists on this definition because they lack belief in God. And so all babies are atheists. In fact, our cat, Muff, is an atheist on this definition because I'm quite sure that Muff has never entertained the thought that God exists, and therefore her psychological state also lacks belief in God. So all of, I mean, even if you want to give them this new definition of atheism, The question still is open, does God exist or not? So whether you call it atheism or schmatheism, let's let atheism be this psychological state and schmatheism be the view that there is no God. What we want to know is schmatheism true or false? That question still remains to be answered, whatever your psychological state might be.
If babies and cats can be atheists, I think there's something wrong with the definition.
Yeah, I do too. And I'm grateful at least that people like Dawkins don't take this kind of weasel route out of the issue. Dawkins is quite hard-nosed and clear that he thinks there is no such being as God.
Why do you think a shift away from the traditional view of atheism, that found in the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, the belief that God does not exist and so on, why do you think there's a backing away of that among perhaps the younger atheists?
Well, my theory about this is that it's because of the indefensibility of atheism, that you can't give any good arguments to think that God does not exist. And by denying that atheism is the view that there is no God, it relieves them of their share of the burden of proof. Now they don't have anything to prove, and they can just fold their arms and sit back and play the skeptic role. And that's so much easier to do, as you know, Kevin, is not to offer any argument of your own, but to just sit back and try to poke holes in somebody else's argument. And that's what this enables them to do, is to just play the skeptic. And as my pastor once pointed out, it doesn't take any brains not to believe something. Anybody can not believe something.
Yeah.
And that's all they're saying they are, is we just lack belief in God. So I think it's really an excuse for intellectual laziness and for the lack of a good case for their point of view.
Time and time again, I hear atheists say, as an atheist, I'm making no claims. Atheism makes no truth claims. It's just a lack of belief. And this is maddening to me because it takes a little while sometimes to get them to see the flaw in that definition and that it's really just agnosticism. If
right.
You want to unpack it. And so.
Exactly. There are actually several views that a person could hold who lacks belief in God. One view would be agnosticism. An agnostic lacks a belief in God. Another would be what is traditionally called atheism. The person who thinks there is no God lacks belief in God. Another would be the person who thinks it's a meaningless question. That would be the view of old line verificationism, which says that unless you can verify something with your five senses, it's neither true nor false. It's just meaningless. That person would also lack a belief in God. And then there's the person who's like a baby or our cat Muff, who's just never thought about it. That person lacks a belief in God. So on this view, atheism, as I say, isn't really a view at all. It's a psychological state that could be shared by quite a number of different types of people who have different viewpoints.
We're going to revisit this in another program because this question has actually come up on the website, reasonablefaith.org. Someone recently asked in the Q&A section, hey, my atheist friends keep throwing this lack of belief in God at me. What's wrong with the definition? You can find your answer there as well when you go to reasonablefaith.org. Out of these atheist authors, Dr. Craig, it seems that Richard Dawkins is the most prominent and kind of the leader of the pack. So let's kind of concentrate on him a little bit.
Okay, good.
He's written a new book called The God Delusion, but he's written a lot on evolution as well. What do we know about Professor Dawkins?
Well, Richard Dawkins is an eminent evolutionary biologist. But what's interesting to me, Kevin, is that the arguments that he gives for atheism in his book are not really scientific arguments that are born out of his area of expertise. They're philosophical arguments. In other words, they're in my area of expertise. And I just find so fascinating that over and over again, I find that it is philosophical considerations that lie at the heart of the unbelief of so many of people. And it is usually on the part of people who are not trained in philosophy, and therefore they make all sorts of mistakes. Now, Dawkins exemplifies this. On pages 157 to 158, if I'm not mistaken, of his book, he presents what he calls the central argument of my book for the non-existence of God, where the conclusion of the argument is that, therefore, God almost certainly does not exist. Now, what is the argument that he gives for that conclusion? Well, it roughly goes like this. He says, the most difficult problem to explain is the apparent design in the universe. But Darwinism has managed to explain the appearance of biological design on the basis of genetic mutation, natural selection, and so forth. We do not yet have, he admits, an explanation in physics for the incredible fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life. But, he says, we ought to be hopeful that such an explanation can be found because we found one in biology, and therefore we have hope that we should find one in physics as well, and that therefore the pursuit should not be abandoned. And therefore, God almost certainly does not exist. Now, that argument, I think, hardly needs to be said, isn't very impressive. It's invalid. Even if you grant all of the premises, all of the steps in the argument, there is no logical rule of inference by which you could validly infer that conclusion. The conclusion just doesn't follow from those premises. And moreover, when you look at some of the premises, I think that they're false or certainly not proven. For example, that premise that in physics we ought to be hopeful that we will find an explanation for the fine-tuning. Well, all that is the expression of the faith of a naturalist. It's just a hope. There's no evidence argued there or presented there that we will be able to explain fine-tuning without intelligence. But the really key move in the argument is his claim that the appeal to intelligent design won't work because once you say that there is an intelligent designer of the universe, you have to confront the question, who designed the designer? And he thinks that this is the real killer against the design argument, that this question, who designed the designer? Now, there's a couple of problems with this response. First of all, what does that argument really prove, that you face the question, who designed the designer? It doesn't prove that a designer doesn't exist. It doesn't prove that God doesn't exist. It doesn't even prove that we're not justified in believing that God exists. At the very most, all this would prove is that you shouldn't conclude or infer to God's existence based on the appearance of design in the universe, that the design argument doesn't work. At the very most, that's all it would prove, is that the design argument doesn't work. And so instead, you ought to rely, say, on the cosmological argument or the moral argument or the ontological argument, or maybe you believe in God on the basis of revelation or miracles or just faith. But clearly, even if the design argument failed, it wouldn't be any sort of proof that God almost certainly does not exist. It would just mean that this particular argument isn't very good. Now, what about that question, though? Does it even succeed in undermining the design argument? Well, I don't think it does, for two reasons. First of all, in order for an explanation to be the best explanation, you don't have to have an explanation of the explanation. In order for an explanation to be the best, you don't have to have an explanation of the explanation. Let me give an example. Suppose archaeologists are digging in the earth and they excavate these artifacts that look like arrowheads and pottery shards and tomahawks. Now, the best explanation for these artifacts would undoubtedly be that they are the products of intelligent design by some unknown group of people, rather than the accidental products of sedimentation and metamorphosis. And this explanation would be the best explanation, even if the archaeologists had not a clue about who these people were or how they came to be there.
I can just picture one of the archaeologists saying to another archaeologist, "Jones, you have no reason to believe that these are tomahawks, arrowheads, and pottery shards because you don't know the explanation of the people who made them."
Exactly. It would be madness, wouldn't it? Or suppose that astronauts got to the moon, and on the backside of the moon, they found a pile of machinery sitting on the moon. Obviously, they would recognize that this is the product of intelligent design, even if they had no clue as to who it was that made this machinery or left it there. So you don't have to have an explanation of the explanation in order to recognize that an explanation is the best. In fact, Kevin, if you think about it, requiring that you have an explanation of the explanation would lead to an infinite regress.
Yeah, who made that and who made that and who made you and who made
it? It would lead to an infinite regress of explanations so that, in fact, nothing could ever be explained. It would destroy science. So Dawkins' principle here that you have to have an explanation of the explanation is really a very anti-scientific principle. It would destroy science because you would never have an explanation of anything. So that invalidates his argument. But there's a second problem with it. He says that you cannot say that God is the explanation of the universe because God is just as complex as the universe is. And so you haven't made any advance in simplicity. He thinks that the better explanation always needs to be a simpler explanation, that you have to have an advance in simplicity in order for an explanation to be preferred. Well, now, that raises all kinds of questions about what are the criteria for being a best explanation. And in fact, simplicity is just one of the criteria for being a good explanation, and it's not even the most important. For example, explanatory scope will be a criterion as well. Does the explanation cover all of the data? And it may well be that in order to cover all of the data, the explanation would be less simple than one that would only explain some of the data. And yet, no one would say, well, we don't want that other explanation because it's more complex. They would say, yes, even though it is more complex, that's overridden by its great explanatory scope. Or it could be overridden by its great explanatory power or some other criterion that goes to make up being a best explanation.
So a simpler entity is not necessarily the better explanation.
Exactly right.
It may require something more complex.
That's entirely possible, and it happens all the time in science. I mean, when you really think about it, the simplest explanation of a set of data would just be the set of data itself. Mm-hmm. Just don't give anything beyond that. And yet, obviously, that would be highly unsatisfactory as an explanation, and yet that would be the simplest. So simplicity is just one of the many criteria that scientists use in assessing theories and assessing which one is the best explanation. But moreover, Dawkins is, I think, completely confused when he says that God is a more complex entity than the universe. What is God when you think about it? Well, God is a spiritual entity. God is an immaterial entity. He's like an unembodied mind. And therefore, God has no physical parts. There is no complexity to his being at all. Any properties that God has as a mind, like intelligence, self-consciousness, and will, are essential to him in order to be a mind. So when you think about it, a mind as an immaterial entity is an incredibly simple substance, far more simple than the physical, complex universe with all its contingent properties and variety.
Working parts and things.
Absolutely. So what Dawkins is obviously confused, I think, here is a mind, which is a very simple entity, with a mind's ideas, which can be very complex. A mind could be thinking of the infinitesimal calculus, for example. A mind can have very complex ideas, but a mind itself is a remarkably simple entity, having no working parts, as you put it. And so Dawkins, I think, has confused a mind's ideas, which may be complex, with a mind itself, which is very simple, and therefore to posit an unembodied designer, a mind behind the cosmos, is definitely an enormous advance in simplicity and is therefore the better explanation.
Our question of the day, Dr. Craig, as people of faith are involved in culture and involved in their world and being an influence for Christ, how should Christians conduct themselves at school board meetings and deal with issues that are controversial and weigh in on spiritual issues?
I've talked to people who are on school boards and have said that the problem with Christians is that they never participate on the school board. They never attend the school board meetings or are part of the school functions until something comes up like sex education or homosexuality or creation science or something of that sort. And then the Christians all come out in droves and demand that the school board do something. And this person said this just creates resentment on the part of the people there because these parents are uninvolved. They're not committed. They don't care until these pet Christian peeves come up. And Christians would have far, far greater influence and credibility if all along the way they were involved in running for the school board, participating in the PTA, attending the meetings, and not just show up at these crisis points when some Christian issue is at stake. So I think that would be, first and foremost, the wider context. They need to get involved.
Then once we do show up, and maybe we have a little time at the microphone, how should we conduct ourselves?
Well, I think it's very important, Kevin, to come prepared. You typically will only be given a very brief time. I remember when I went to the Cobb County school board meeting that was debating having a sticker concerning evolution put into the biology textbook. We were given a minute and a half, 90 seconds. And if you're not to waste that, you've got to be well prepared to think what you're going to say, maybe even practice it, so that you don't waste your time and say silly things. So I would say, first and foremost, come prepared. Have people selected who would be good spokesmen for your cause, who will be articulate and can enunciate the viewpoint accurately. And then behave in a way that is proper decorum for such a meeting. Don't shout, don't get emotional or angry, but behave as a rational and civil person in the dialogue.
For more resources like these from Dr. William Lane Craig, go to reasonablefaith.org. That's reasonablefaith.org.